Thank you, Elise, and thanks to the Poetry Center for inviting me and us to read. I'm going to read three pieces. Different from some older stuff, and I'll move into some more recent stuff. The last piece that I read, called The Note, appeared in the most recent issue of Tripwire, published by David Book. And these three pieces kind of mark a progression for me in the work that I'm working on. I arrived on a hill. There were trees in the distance. I couldn't see beyond the boundary of the trees, but I knew I would have to get past them. It is unclear to me the differences between want and need. I arrived without having to get there. I walked on the path through the checkpoint, the gate where they checked our passes. I walked along a fence in the back, talking with someone. She was older than me, but only by a few years. She was thinking about the problems of want and need, questions she asked me to reflect upon. A bright light filled in the space where she was standing. Children held sticks, ran around. We could hear them yelling in the background. The screens faded up and out. I was helping her think, not with thoughts of my own, more with hers. We found a clearing and turned toward it. She reached for my arm. Her hand never made contact. Up ahead in the distance, the line of trees blurred, the sound of children's voices muffled. In the fog, I am whole with no boundaries. Under the bright sun, once was cold, she clicked her tongue and turned. It won't go easy, a voice we heard say from outside our heads. I brought my left hand to my temple to pause, collect myself, or make sense of the voices I heard while her talking kept on, proceeded, I may have said at one point, and nodded my head while touching the left temple with middle finger. One of the screens sank down. On the other side of the fence, a swimming pool, empty and covered in leaves, dirt, twigs, and bugs. I motioned for help. The sun was sinking just at the horizon. She was not to let me go. It was an order from somewhere, someone I had to trust. Every meadow, a blank side, over the passage, from above the tilted window. I turned around. No one was holding the mirror in front of or behind myself. A head around the center fell down the gaping hole from where we had arrived was not gone. His hands are in his pockets. His left hand holds a stone. His hand turns the stone around in his pocket, holds the stone tight. This is soothing to him. It grounds him. I am unsettling to him. I know it. Our walk along the road goes uphill and then downhill. We pass a shopping center. We pass tents under a freeway overpass. We pass a bar. We arrive at an art school. He and I walk into the art school and down the long hallway. Our rubber-bottomed shoes step silently over the shiny floor. My right hand holds the phone inside my pocket. I take the hand out. We walk through the back of the building and out into the street. A ragged street, a cart overturned, a pile of soiled clothes. The wind whips and stops, sun rays crashing down at an angle. His arms are swinging as we walk. He kicks a piece of glass. When I was a child, I was ushered into a body of water that was surrounded by fire. This is what they told me, the beings that tell stories when we sleep. The old wooden apartment I moved into with a friend, 2001, running into the old landlady who almost didn't rent to us, one dyke and one trans guy, or two dykes, or two trans guys, whatever combination was seen. We did move in, never met the neighbors. Till one day a neighbor rang our doorbell with a note in their hand, a note someone had written to me. It caused them to worry and ask if I was okay. They knew something I didn't want to, that I was in danger. It's not simple to encounter the world and leave things out. The omitted parts accumulate, build an edifice of all the stories that could have been told, becoming a story of their own. Everybody's got them. The unspoken tower. The rest of the figures arrive. I hold all their bags as they climb the stairs ahead of me. I've got one on my back hanging from shoulders, one slung to the side, and one in each hand as I climb the top floor of the old spiral staircase and pull a metal key out of my pocket. It starts with a poem, he says in the room. Everyone listens as he tells the story of a building he had previously left out. What I'm trying to recover is a sense of myself in that moment, in the construction of a house, makeup of the place behind walls, what had fallen into, ruin, disintegrated, unused. I would like for you to destroy it. His steps slow. I adjust to match his pace. He stops. Looking out into the urban wilderness, overgrown weeds take over the median. A mattress leans against the side of an electric pole, sinking toward the street on both ends. A truck barrels past. The walls of the interior of the apartment were a dirty yellow. Curtains and the way he drew them closed as everyone gathered. I was standing in the middle of the room with a thought. It was not yet formed, slowly emerged like a bubble blown on the end of a plastic ring. When he entered the room, it popped. I lost it, I said. To indicate the thought was still moist, like the dream you had and left forgotten. There we stayed. Was I in the kitchen when she got home, I asked, saying hello to the man leaning against the cabinets by the fridge. No, it wasn't me, nor was it him or them or them. There was a moment I saw where this scene plays out, adopted for a section of writing I still haven't used, lost with some crust and excess, a lot of messy dust. On the staircase, a few of the steps creaked as we walked. Someone was singing. Someone else was working. Someone decided what that means. As in a dream, I told the story and he listened. And in the story, it was he who walked beside me and my hands bunched in my own pockets, reaching for a key. Inside, the crew was waiting to be told who was who, which body we would reside in to do the deed, who would dictate the terms and who would agree. 10 years go by, then 100. One emerges from a swamp with a ring of flames around. Someone emerges out as me, 10 more years, then a century and a half. He said something about that too, the same thing in every era. I held the roll of duct tape in my hands, strapped his ankles to the chair legs. You thought you were getting out of this. The margin of error tightens, tearing a piece of tape with the teeth, shrill sound of the rip. The wall behind the wall painted yellow, aged and unseen. Then his wrists, one by one, tied to the wooden arms. He was breathing steadily. He seemed to be pleased. The tape came round back of head and over the mouth, almost covered the nostrils, enough to feel expressed air against itself. There was kindling in the corner, an expert in explosives, someone reporting from the scene. Another one might not make it out, knew it too. The next day he bought a paper from a newsstand with a nickel, sat on a park bench, adjusted his wide-brimmed hat, fanned out the paper before him. What's all the commotion? There, someone pointed to the building. It was a poem I once wrote, he thinks. But she never would have told him. The building was supposed to go, but it stayed, standing there, its resting place before you. The note. As I walk home from work, my head hangs, shoulders slumped. It is 2006 in Oakland, California, and I walk everywhere like I'm rushed to get to where I'm going, hunched and looking down at the ground. I see a note on the sidewalk. It reminds me of a note someone once wrote to me. There's a knock at the door. It's my neighbors who I've never spoken to. I am in Portland, Oregon in 2001. A note hangs from their hand. Is this yours? I take it and say thanks. The neighbors ask if I'm okay. I say I'm fine, it was just a joke. They seem genuinely concerned for my well-being. Seldom looks up from beneath a layer of sludge. I look down and try to catch his eye, but what can we say to each other? A double vision intercepted by ripples on the surface of a pond in different worlds tethered by a thread. I look down at the note in my hand. At the time, my girlfriend had not yet punched me repeatedly in the head, strangled my throat, or kicked me while I was on the ground. She hadn't yet taken the alarm clock cord and wound it around my neck, pulling the wire at both ends. I hadn't yet called the cops because I thought she was going to kill me and had no other way out. Something in the neighbor's face held a warning to me from something they had seen in the note, something I didn't see in the note, but saw in their face, and then promptly forgot about after closing the front door. It's filthy, Seldom, Ven says, but they want the filth in animals too, make it funny, a little pathetic, so they chuckle through the filter of your self-narration. They need to know your politics are in the right place too. Is it 2018? Otherwise you can't be a star in your own reversed mirror. Don't you wish to have been born of a different era among mounting beasts of the web, cavalry raising dirt under their hoofs beside those trenches where you lay? Ven asks with a smirk while looking up over her glasses, Seldom shakes his head. Did I say that? Did I ask how the text is like a slaughtered animal? I wrote a book over the years 2011 to 2015 that contained an I character that was never stable, sometimes a woman, sometimes a man, sometimes an ungendered person or a person with an unmarked gender, sometimes a person who was a different gender from the way they dressed or were perceived. The character finds themselves in a variety of environments and situations carrying out experiments. The book felt continuous to me at the time, but I can see now that it starts and stops a lot. The central character is pretty inaccessible, and the changing landscape never seems to settle. It doesn't quite carry you through. When I get home from work at the coffee shop, I say hi to my cat and quickly make some food to eat. Then I walk to the bar and start drinking. The bar I mean is the White Horse Inn, the oldest continually running gay bar in the country, the bar where Jack Spicer used to drink. I go there almost every night and drink too much. It's 2008. And I'm writing a piece called The Line Curves Where You Live, about living on the border of Oakland and Berkeley. It was also about my exploits as a person who drinks too much and sleeps with a lot of people, about the disintegration of a relationship and the desperation I felt and all the sleeping around, the drinking and drugs, the woman 12 years older than me who I was obsessed with for many years and who I started dating in Portland in 2005 just before moving to Oakland and how things quickly ended after I moved. I wrote about all that too. I couldn't stand the piece. The writing was so direct, too vulnerable. I wasn't ready for sentences. So I decided to chop it up. For every three words, I removed one word. I had no idea how the piece would turn out, but it felt cathartic as a practice. The piece of writing became much better, felt almost thrilling the first time I read it all the way through. After Janice left in 2002, I spent a lot of time at the E Room, the Egyptian Club, the now gone lesbian bar in Portland, which you could say was like the precursor to my White Horse days. Both were dark gay bars with outdated decor, pool tables, karaoke nights, and a dance room. I would drink Jameson on the rocks and smoke Camel Lights and wear a leather jacket and shoot pool. There was something very deep inside me that felt satisfied by this as my way of life. It felt destructive, but real, like I was accessing something secretive, like desire. I chopped off all my hair for the second time. I read Stone Butch Blues for the first time. I tried using a packer, it didn't feel right. I flinched when my new girlfriend would make a sudden motion. I smoked inside the bar. I kept my eyes on everyone. Was it a book of prose that should have been verse, or vice versa? It was not so easy to decide to start taking hormones or to get top surgery. Certainly not as easy as it was to remove one word for every three words, and then the poem was better. Then the form held the content in a way that worked. Seldom walks beside Hugh. Hugh drops back for a second and kicks Seldom's ankle to the side as he takes a step. He stumbles and jerks. They laugh. Seldom is startled to see Hugh in this way, jovial and light-footed. They have a boyish look, pretty, with something heavy and dark in there, too. He feels bashful around them. They walk with their hands in their pockets, talking about a book they're reading. They're already on to the next subject, but he's still somewhere before, not thinking anything specific, just an ambient sort of processing in the back of his mind that keeps him distracted from being present. It wasn't the village they strolled through on a path that led them back here once again. The story for someone to see, written once from above, then beside. From beneath the sludge he looks up, then back down to the page. Which ones are whose? Which verses are the ones that caught you looking? Seldom signs his name at the bottom of the page. Every 5 or 10 years I find myself thumbing through old journals. Usually it's when I'm moving. This is the day in my packing up of a place where I don't do any packing up. Instead, I read through all the old journals and notebooks, the old folders stuffed with writing from my younger years. Sometimes I skip over the two journals that cover the 9 months when I dated Janice. In these pages, things go dark. The appearance of my writing changes. Letters look more angular and sharp, written with a depressed and frantic energy. The pen impressions seem to be dug deeper into the page. I look at the pages where we scribbled words and drawings together about her abusive behavior as a way of talking about it. I see myself sitting next to Janice in the Red and Black Cafe on Division Street in Portland as I draw an image of myself with welts all over my head, and she writes captions to explain why I deserved them. The Red and Black was an anarchist collective coffee shop and gathering space a few blocks from where I lived in Southeast Portland. Morgan used to give me free bowls of chili when I was broke. I would use their computers to check my Hotmail account. It was 2002 when I was sitting on the ground outside in a hoodie smoking a cigarette. Walt Curtis stopped in front of me and asked if I was a homeless boy. I said no. He turned and walked away. I moved back to this neighborhood on the border of Oakland and Berkeley at the end of 2017, this time South Berkeley. I walked to the coffee shop where I used to go when I moved to the neighborhood in 2005 in North Oakland. It's the same coffee shop where I wrote The Line Curves Where You Live. Now I write here in the same coffee shop about that piece, how I cut one word for every three words and made it better. I walk on the same streets, but my head no longer hangs. My shoulders are less slumped. I walk a little less rushed. I'm still the same person, same anxieties and fears, same delusions, but I have more presence and intention. More stillness. This is partly because I transitioned, but is also because I grew up. I did a lot of work. I mean, inner work that's invisible. When I get pushed on a stretcher into an operating room or start inserting a needle into my body once a week, I receive many congratulations. My first book was an accurate representation of where I was at the time of writing it. I now long to tell another story, one that may jump around in time and contradict itself, that may draw from real and imaginary landscapes of people and environments, that has unstable subjects and speakers, that conveys my body embodied state today. Chase pokes out from a pile of leaves. Hugh looks at him through the window as they wipe their hands on a towel. Ven comes up the stairs from the basement and stands in the doorway tapping her foot. She's giving Samuel a call, but he doesn't answer. He's waiting in the swamp, moving his arms around to catch pieces of the composition. When he brings them back in a bucket, Seldom will wash them off. I place them in my mouth one by one to feel out their potential. Chase rakes the leaves into a pile so he can jump into them again, then goes back downstairs. I remember being particularly pleased to be mistaken for a boy, not only by Walt Curtis, but in all instances when it happened. I was just beginning to be a lesbian, a dyke, in those early Portland years. When Janice brought me to the emergency room, a nurse asked her to leave the room for a moment and hand me some pamphlets. After one violent night, I went to work at the store that used to be called Nature's and then was called Wild Oats and later became Whole Foods. I was working behind the deli counter when Janice showed up to say that she had packed her car and was driving to Los Angeles for good. In that moment, I became free of her. But not by my own doing. It happened 2 weeks before we were about to move in together. The building is starting to disintegrate. We are going to let it be so. Blood of a pig coasting through the streets in the village after writing something that wanted to show up in a way and didn't, after I sat myself down on the curb and wondered how I would ever come to write about myself in this way, and seldom says, how the building comes to be the story, seldom tells through your window. All along, he had forgotten about the piece he was trying to write a few years ago in which the text was a body, a slaughtered animal, a book to be prose, or could it be verse? The body of work holds its previous versions inside, invisible and present, building its aura out of them. I reach my hand into the swamp and pluck seldom out, my wrist and forearm dripping with mud and saliva, blood and gunk, the stuff of old writing, old bodies and selves, thoughts and desires, the old versions of us, everybody's got 'em. A note lying on the sidewalk. Thank you.